digital age that is widely deployed. But as with fire or electricity, we understand that to maintain, to obtain the benefits, you know, you also need to put in some safeguards and some limits. And you see, we're actually in a moment right now where the AI techniques are being broadly deployed with hardly any safeguards or limits. And that's why so many people in the AI community are worried. It's not that they don't see the benefits, it's that they see the risks if we continue down this path.
Well, we want to talk about what those safeguards need to be and dig further into how it is that artificial intelligence could lead to the extinction of humans on Earth. We're talking to Mark Rotenberg, Executive Director of the Center for AI and Digital Policy. We'll do part two. Put it online at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. KBOO's Board of Directors meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland and online through a public video conference. Masks and proof of vaccination are required at this time. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Prison Pipeline is a radio program dedicated to educating the public about the Oregon criminal justice system. Topics include incarceration and reentry, addictions and mental health, elections and laws, victims' rights, and criminal justice reform. The program presents a unique understanding of the criminal justice system, addresses the root causes of crime, and challenges the status quo. It seeks to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safer, healthier, and more just society.
Prison Pipeline airs on Monday evenings from 6:30 to 7 p.m. on KBOO Portland. Check us out every week. If you miss an episode, you can stream it later. Just go to kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. More info about upcoming shows and events related to the prison community can be found on our Facebook page, Prison Pipeline. Be sure to like us.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, what's in the $7 billion spending plan for Portland? We take an in-depth look. Some Oregon citizens are going to take a bigger role in conservation on precious coastline. And what comes next for the Snake River, as its aging dams are about to be removed with the hope of reviving stressed salmon?
We will save salmon, and we will uphold our treaty responsibilities.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, May 18th, 2023. I'm Annette Newell. Glad to have you with us tonight. The Portland City Council has preliminarily approved next year's budget, coming in at just over $7 billion. KBOO's Josh Salem goes in-depth on the story.
Yesterday, the Portland City Council tentatively approved a $7.1 billion budget for next year. It includes a remodel of the city's government structure, in a freeze or at least a reduction in planned increases to city utility bills and other fees. That last part was controversial. 5 days ago, Mayor Ted Wheeler put forward a proposal to freeze a 40-cent per hour increase in parking meter costs. He also proposed reducing a planned utility rate hike for water and sewer services. Mayor Wheeler was apparently trying to keep people and businesses from leaving Portland. However, some commissioners argued the reductions would gravely undercut the city's ability to provide basic services and might lead to massive layoffs. Mingus Mapps was the sole commissioner to vote against what he called a remarkably bad budget. Commissioner Rene Gonzalez opposed several of Wheeler's budget amendments but ultimately approved the spending plan. Withholding the fee increases would reduce the Portland Bureau of Transportation's budget by $8.3 million, the Portland Water Bureau's budget by $2.4 million, and the Portland Bureau of Environmental Services by $8 million. The cuts will threaten multiple staff positions and adversely affect multifamily utility assistance programs. The cuts will also halt plans to replace the 60-year-old Tryon Creek wastewater treatment plant and delay federally mandated work to clean up polluted areas, like the Portland Harbor Superfund site. Finally, the Portland Bureau of Transportation feels a pause on its first parking meter fee increase since 2016 could lead to street maintenance delays, reductions in traffic safety programs, and program cuts. Wheeler's plan apparently has the backing of local development and business groups. John Isaacs, a spokesperson for Portland Business Alliance, said in a letter to the Portland City Council, quote, "If we can't break the habit of just demanding Portlanders pay more and more, we now know a growing number will choose to move on to more affordable communities," end quote. Commissioners spent most of yesterday's budget hearing debating last-minute revenue changes, which only represent a small fraction of the total budget. The budget passed Wednesday also included an amendment that restores $250,000 to fund grants to help nonprofits run leadership development programs for communities of color, immigrants, and refugees. Wheeler's initial budget slashed this funding. The City Council is scheduled to take a final vote on the city budget in mid-June. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
We have two stories tonight about conservation in the Pacific Northwest and how it affects our waterways. First, local residents will help manage two marine conservation areas in Oregon. This comes after the state's new designation of the areas at Cape Foulweather and Cape Lookout in Lincoln County, as Eric Tegedoff reports.
Locals will help steward two iconic locations on Oregon's coast. The Cape Foulweather Complex and Cape Lookout Marine Conservation Areas were approved for designation in April by the Oregon Land Conservation and Development Commission. The Audubon Society of Lincoln City plans to recruit local residents for stewardship in 2025. Kent Doty with the organization says it's a unique approach to conservation.
It's bottom-up management for sites that local communities really care and love. For the community to really get a say in how a site is managed and cared for.
The areas have broad support from local communities. Every resident of the neighborhood near Cape Foulweather signed a letter in support of the conservation area designation. Both areas are known for being home to thousands of nesting seabirds. Doty says other larger creatures can also be seen at Cape Foulweather, for instance.
Amazing views almost any day of the year. You can see whales feeding in the kelp beds. So it's a pretty incredible place.
Kelp forest restoration will be important at Cape Lookout, he says. His organization is planning on finding ways to incorporate outdoor education programs through nearby Camp Merriweather at the site as well. Support for this reporting was provided by the Pew Charitable Trusts. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Meanwhile, in Washington state, lawmakers are planning to put more than $7 million to start the transition process once four dams on the lower Snake River are removed. The dams are aging, which is reducing their usefulness for energy production, but even more important, they're hurting endangered salmon. Here again is Eric Tegedoff with that part of the story.
Funding in Washington state's budget pushes efforts forward to remove four lower Snake River dams in order to save salmon. Lawmakers committed more than $7 million to begin the transition planning process for the four dams in southeast Washington. The dams have been a site of contention because of their effects on the dwindling population of salmon. Tanya Reardon with Save Our Wild Salmon says past studies and reports have called for dam removal, but these funding efforts show the federal government the state is ready to take action.
Although the decision to remove the dams will be made by the federal government, they're federal dams, these measures do ensure that Washington State will be prepared to effectively replace the transportation, energy, and irrigation infrastructure.
Last year, Governor Jay Inslee and Senator Patty Murray released a report on replacement of the four dam services. That includes barging, hydropower, and irrigation provided to nearby agriculture. Reardon says this funding measure follows through on that promise. Inslee signed the budget this week. Aaron Ferris Olson with the National Wildlife Federation says salmon are resilient and have come back to the Snake River, albeit in smaller numbers. She says quick action is necessary to save them.
We're moving at the pace of our own readiness as humans, more so than we're thinking about the ticking of the clock in terms of salmon extinction.
Reardon says more than $26 billion have been spent on mitigation efforts to recover salmon and keep the dams in place, but they haven't worked. And she says there are a number of advantages to transitioning away from them.
We upgrade and modernize our energy system and transportation and irrigation, and the state is benefited and communities will be benefited significantly through this process. And we'll save salmon, and we will uphold our treaty responsibilities to tribal nations.
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
It was 2 years ago that senators, including Oregon's Ron Wyden, voted on the Clean Energy for America Act. And a lot has happened since then. Today, Senator Wyden spoke at a Finance Committee meeting about what the act did for jobs and energy.
2 years ago, almost to this day, the committee voted on the Clean Energy for America Act in a room just a few doors away. In writing that legislation, our lodestar was developing a technology-neutral, market-oriented energy policy in which the more you reduce carbon emissions, the bigger your tax savings. The Senate Finance Committee, over a 100-year period, has never done anything approaching this in terms of energy policy. The old status quo, big breaks for big oil, and major uncertainty for clean energy was holding our economy back, and it was stifling innovation. Since Democrats passed the IRA, there has been an explosion of new investment announced in clean energy projects around the country. Wind energy, solar, electric vehicle manufacturing, energy storage, just a few. So far, those announcements add up to nearly $250 billion of private investment coming off the sidelines. Nearly 150,000 jobs created, many of which do not require a college degree. One new analysis broke the announcement down by state. Here are a few examples relevant to the committee. North Carolina, $5.6 billion. South Carolina, $11 billion. Ohio, $7.8 billion, a significant portion of which is solar manufacturing that our colleague from Ohio, Senator Brown, battled for to make sure that the bill would include it. Texas, $5 billion. Tennessee, $5.6 billion. Michigan, $20 billion. These projects are taking over from sea to shining sea. They have exceeded expectations. The investments help America cut carbon emissions. They help America prevent the worst climate disasters. They help fire up the economic engine for whole communities where the shovels are going into the ground. A big part of our effort in the IRA was giving a special boost to coal towns and other communities built around extractive industries. The status quo had failed them. Plants shuttered, and the people in those communities were too often overlooked and forgotten. When this committee wrote the Inflation Reduction Act, people in coal towns had no bigger champion than Senator Casey. He worked to create a special program called Energy Communities. With energy communities, there is a bonus incentive to drive investment in struggling coal towns and areas with similar histories. My seatmate here, Senator Stabenow, ensured that those communities would get an extra boost for advanced manufacturing. And I will just tell my colleagues, over the 10-year odyssey from the time I went to West Virginia at Senator Manchin's request, Senator Stabenow was out in front on this issue of advanced manufacturing, and it is in the bill because of her leadership. Senator Cortez Masto made sure the law would also attract investment to communities with areas known as brownfields, which are often the polluted remnants of old industrial facilities. This work continues a long-standing effort by Finance Committee Democrats to stand up and go to bat for coal miners and their families. Senator Brown and Senator Casey fought for years to shore up the miners' health care and pensions. Senator Warner and Senator Carper were also co-sponsors of the legislation that got that done. So, colleagues, the IRA is major progress on clean energy that's just beginning to take off now that the rules pertaining to energy communities were recently put in place. The catch is, House Republicans want to repeal nearly all of the energy policies in the Inflation Reduction Act. That's what the McCarthy plan does. In my view, and I want to be clear about it, that McCarthy plan is a major act of economic self-sabotage. That's because the majority of the investments announced since the IRA became law are going to states represented by Republican senators.
That was Oregon U.S. Senator Ron Wyden today speaking in a Senate hearing. Statistics show hate crimes targeting Black people rose 12.5% between 2020 and 2021 in California. Now, the Act Against Hate Alliance brought together civil rights experts from across the U.S. and Europe this week for a briefing on how to fight hate crimes. Suzanne Potter reports.
Civil rights groups are forging connections to fight the rising tide of hate crimes. In a briefing from the Act Against Hate Alliance on Wednesday, civil rights leaders explained efforts to enlist regular people, advocacy groups, governments, and corporations in the fight against hate. Laura E. Ellsworth with the law firm Jones Day organizes the annual Eradicate Hate Global Summit in Pittsburgh, the site of the 2018 massacre at the Tree of Life Synagogue.
Whether it be against LGBT people or immigrants in El Paso or Jews again in Poway or Sikhs in Oak Creek or Asians throughout California, again and again and again, we saw this identity-based violence.
5 months ago, California was scarred by a mass shooting that killed 11 Asian Americans during the Lunar New Year celebration at two dance halls in Monterey Park. A year ago, a white supremacist gunman targeted Black shoppers, killing 10 at a supermarket in Buffalo, New York. Recently, Governor Gavin Newsom announced two new ways to report hate speech and hate crimes by logging on to the website caversushate.org or calling 833-8-NO-HATE. Tomas Barracks with the International Network Against Cyber Hate in the Netherlands says his organization responds to complaints of online hate speech and manages a database to monitor trends in cyber hate.
Hate speech is not always followed by hate crime, but hate crimes are very, very often or almost always preceded by hate speech.
May is Asian Pacific American Heritage Month. Dennis Santiago is CEO of the National Diversity Coalition based in Los Angeles. He says his organization tries to fight the myth of the Pacific Rim cultures as a monolith.
Each one of them has beachhead cultures in the United States, and every single one of them has very different characteristics in terms of their economic integration, their cultural isolation, even from each other.
The 2021 California Hate Crime Report found that hate crimes increased more than 32% in the Golden State between 2020 and 2021. Anti-Asian hate crime events increased dramatically, rising 177.5% during that time. I'm Suzanne Potter.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News In Depth, featuring the Global Citizen International Digest, and then an interview about a local NACPA rally happening this weekend. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio, then American Indian Airwaves at 7. Tonight's weather, mostly clear skies with a couple of passing clouds, a low of 56. Tomorrow's weather, clouds in the morning, giving way to mostly sunny skies in the afternoon, up to a high of 83. Today in history, on this date in 1980, Mount St. Helens had a massive eruption, killing 57 people and devastating more than 200 square miles of wilderness. Our quote of the day is from Harry S. Truman, who owned Mount St. Helens Lodge. "They'll never get me off this mountain. Spirit Lake and Mount St. Helens are a part of me. They're mine. They're as much a part of me as my arms and legs." The Texas legislature aims to strip local control away from cities. North Carolina Republicans override a veto of the state's abortion ban, and the U.S. Supreme Court says an assault weapons ban in Illinois can stay for now. With more on the stories impacting our democracy, here's today's edition of 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
Thomas Jefferson wrote, "The government closest to the people serves the people best." But this bill obliterates small government.
Texas State Senator Sarah Eckhart condemned the passage of a bill intended to strip local control from the state's largely Democratic-run cities and shift control to its Republican-run legislature. Critics say the bill could drastically limit local government's ability to make progressive rules regarding labor rights, predatory lending, and more. Supporters of the bill, including Governor Greg Abbott, say the bill is needed to provide statewide consistency for small businesses. A ban on abortions after 12 weeks will remain the law in North Carolina after the GOP-led legislature overrode Governor Roy Cooper's veto.
This vote shows that Republicans are completely unified in their assault on women's reproductive care.
Cooper pointed out the bill was never allowed public input or amendments. The ACLU said lawmakers are ignoring the democratic process in order to push through unpopular legislation against the will of the people. The 5th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals began hearing arguments Wednesday in the Biden administration's efforts to overturn a Texas judge's decision banning the abortion medication mifepristone. A decision is not expected for weeks. The U.S. Supreme Court says the state of Illinois can keep its ban on assault weapons in place for now. The justices denied an emergency request challenging the law. Carrie Fliegler of Moms Demand Action Illinois says the ban is meant to save lives.
We really want to make clear that we are not against guns. We really aren't. We are pro-safety, and there's a way to get that done.
Illinois passed the assault weapons ban after a gunman killed seven people and injured dozens more at a Highland Park, Illinois, 4th of July parade last year. Congressman Hank Johnson of Georgia says it's time to pass the Judiciary Act to expand the Supreme Court.
A 6-3 far-right supermajority on the United States Supreme Court threatens our rights, our democracy, and our planet.
Johnson and fellow Democrats want 4 seats added for a total of 13 justices. They say it will better protect the nation against partisan rulings like last year's overturning of Roe v. Wade. Book publisher Penguin Random House and free speech organization PEN America have filed a lawsuit against a Pensacola, Florida school district. They allege the district violated the First Amendment by removing more than 150 books, of which 60% dealt with race or LGBTQ issues. Washington Governor Jay Inslee has signed a major new drug policy to keep controlled substances illegal while encouraging prosecutors to divert cases for addiction treatment. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
Lawsuits across the country are aiming at taking away women's right to abortions. Today brought an expert briefing about the health risks of denying people abortions and the potential impact of ongoing lawsuits trying to restrict access to medication abortion across the country. Here are some thoughts about that from lawyer Joanne Rosen, a lecturer on health policy at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health.
By my count, there are 6 ongoing legal challenges right now involving mifepristone. 2 of these challenges seek to remove access to mifepristone, and 4 are seeking to broaden or protect this access. The case that is especially consequential at the moment is Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine versus FDA. That's the Texas case. It has been extensively covered, but I will touch on it briefly. This is the case that was argued yesterday in the 5th Circuit Court of Appeals. The plaintiffs in this case are a coalition of anti-abortion organizations and physicians, and they are seeking to revoke the FDA's longstanding approval of mifepristone and thereby remove it nationwide. And to provide just a bit of context, medication abortion has been the most common method of pregnancy termination since 2020. In the year 2020, it was used in 53% of abortions. It has also been safely used by over 5.3 million women in the U.S. since the drug was first approved in 2000. The plaintiffs in this case obtained a preliminary order in April at the trial level that stayed all of the FDA's approvals and decisions on mifepristone nationwide. And if that trial level order had been allowed to remain in effect, it would have blocked lawful access to mifepristone, even in those states that have elected to protect abortion. Following 2 very intense weeks of emergency appeals, the Supreme Court blocked the preliminary stay, and they reinstated access to mifepristone, or the mifepristone status quo, for the duration of the litigation. The implications of this case are extraordinary, and they include the potential termination of access to mifepristone, a precedent for court interference in the FDA's rigorous and science-based testing and approval process, not just for mifepristone, but for any drug, And of note, if the challenger's case succeeds here, this would be the first time in history that a court has abrogated the FDA's approval of a drug over the objections of the FDA. And it would also be a precedent that would result in the substantial alteration of the Supreme Court's rules with respect to standing, or who is legally entitled to bring a challenge, and would thereby open the door to a near infinite class of persons who could challenge the FDA's approval of this or any other drug. Finally, the Dobbs opinion has breathed new life into some abortion opponents' efforts to enforce the 1873 Comstock Act and to try to employ it as a tool to thwart abortion nationwide by banning the mailing or transport of abortion pills and potentially the mailing of medical instruments and devices that are used to perform procedural or surgical abortions. And the Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine case is an example of this strategy. I expect that we will see a lot more litigation of this type, including efforts to use the Comstock Act as another means of banishing abortion nationwide.
That was Joanne Rosen with the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Arizona and the FBI are looking at fake health providers targeting Native communities. An Alaska planning group will no longer include an Alaska Native village. And First Lady Biden makes an historic visit to Bethel, Alaska, to promote rural broadband. With these stories and more, here's National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Arizona Governor Katie Hobbs and others say fake healthcare providers have defrauded the state out of hundreds of millions of dollars. As Arizona Public Radio's Ryan Heinches reports, the schemes allegedly target Native American communities.
Officials say for nearly 3 years, more than 100 treatment centers in the Phoenix area have fraudulently billed Arizona's Medicaid system for services they didn't deliver. The providers often lure Native Americans from reservations who are experiencing homelessness or have mental health or substance abuse problems. The would-be patients are frequently held against their will and rarely given the promised treatment. The U.S. Attorney's Office and the FBI have been investigating. Antoinette Ferrari is an FBI special agent.
These individuals are targeting Native Americans because there is a lower threshold in order to bill for behavioral health services. So we're just seeing a mismatch between what's actually happening and what is supposed to happen.
At a press conference, Governor Hobbs called the situation a humanitarian crisis that's believed to have contributed to the epidemic of missing Indigenous people. She said the providers have been cut off from receiving payments and other systemic reforms will be put in place. So far, 45 indictments have been handed down and about $75 million have been recovered. A statewide hotline has been set up to report missing people. Many victims are believed to be members of the Navajo Nation, and according to Attorney General Ethel Branch, the tribe will open a command center to assist victims and families. For National Native News, I'm Ryan Heinches in Flagstaff.
After more than 9 months of debate, the scope of an Alaska planning group will shrink to no longer include 3.5 million acres and an Alaska Native village within its boundaries. Riley Board with KDLL and Kenai reports.
On Alaska's Kenai Peninsula, two communities on opposite sides of a major waterway have been in conflict for months over the scope of a land planning group based out of the east side community of Nikiski. The planning group was established last September following advocacy from residents who wanted a say in local planning decisions. The original boundaries encompassed Nikiski, surrounding land on the east side of Cook Inlet, and millions of acres on the west side. Within them, the native village of Tyonik. Representatives from Nikiski argued the two areas, though geographically separated, were one community. But West Side residents rejected the description of the West Side as part of the Nikiski community and said the decision to form a planning group was made without their consent. In December, local officials introduced an ordinance to reduce the size of the planning area's boundaries. This week, the borough's governing body, the Borough Assembly, finally voted to reduce the area to just the east side of the inlet, following several proposed amendments and a lengthy postponement. Assembly President Brent Johnson said it was important to honor the input from the West Side, which included dozens of letters from Tyonik residents and Peninsula Native corporations.
I'm looking at the strong feelings of the folks that live on the other side of the inlet in the Tyonik area. They have very strong feelings They don't want to have a APC that's on the east side telling people on the west side what to do.
The group's new boundaries include about 300,000 acres, which still makes it the largest of its kind in the borough. For National Native News, I'm Riley Board.
First Lady Jill Biden traveled to Bethel, Alaska Wednesday. She highlighted the administration's work to improve broadband in the YK Delta, which Biden says will help with healthcare, education, and jobs. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland and Congresswoman Mary Peltola joined the First Lady on the visit. This was the first ever visit by a First Lady to Bethel. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, May 18th, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Tammy Habteas, Mel Gertoff, Eric Tegadoff, and Suzanne Potter. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM. K2A2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth, up next featuring the Global Citizen International Digest with Mel Gertoff.